now time for us to begin. I'm going to turn this over to Janet Atwood, the cover editor for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. This is Janet Atwood, and I'm the cover editor, as Chris said, for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise magazine, and co-author of The Passion Test, The Effortless Path to Discovering Your Destiny. This is the Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise Passion Series, in case someone's on the wrong call, where twice a month we interview individuals who have been remarkably successful in following their passions and creating an extraordinary life. The purpose behind these calls is to help you understand how others discovered and lived their passions so that you can discover yours and give your unique gifts to the world. I love E.M. Forster's quote. It's just one of my favorites. One person with passion is better than 40 people merely interested. Our guest tonight, and I am so excited about our guest tonight, has inspired passion in millions of people around the world for more than 25 years. His autobiographical novel, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, was totally a major source of inspiration for me when I first read it. And I know it has been for millions around the world and for all of you. This year, The Peaceful Warrior, a feature-length film starring Nick Nolte, based on Dan's book, was released by Lionsgate. It's an incredible movie. I was totally just stuck on the whole film. I wouldn't move from my seat, and I was just like 100% into it. And I urge all of our listeners to go out and get it and see it as soon as this call is over. You'll love it. You've got to go like tonight. But stay for the call first. Dan is a former world champion athlete, a university coach, a martial arts instructor, and a college professor. His books, including The Journey of Socrates, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, Everyday Enlightenment, and The Life You Were Born to Live, have inspired 29 languages. His keynote seminars, his trainings, have influenced people from all walks of life and all ages, including leaders in the field of health, psychology, education, business, politics, sports, entertainment, and the arts. Dan and his wife Joy live in Northern California. He has 3 grown daughters and 2 grandsons. Dan, we are so honored and thrilled to have you with us tonight. Can you tell by my voice?
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Janet, and Alan and Chris.
Thank you. It's just so great. My co-host tonight is Alan Hunken, the founder and president of Success Talk Radio, which offers over more than 45 channels of online interview content on success in every possible area of human life. You can check out those interviews by going to www.successtalk.com. Alan, thanks so much for being with us to conduct tonight's interview.
I couldn't be happier. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this.
Oh, it's our honor. So I'll hand it over to you, and thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you. Dan Millman, nice to finally talk to you. In 540 interviews and 10 years on the Internet doing interviews with thought leaders around the world, this is the first time that you and I have spoken.
Amazing.
It's amazing. You know, I have a little book that I wrote about worthiness, and so I'm just really interested to find out how I successfully avoided meeting you up until now, and what the lessons there are for us tonight for sure on this call. Dan, we're talking tonight about passion and the things that are most important to you. How did those things that were the most important to you in your life lead you to the work that you do today?
Well, let me first say I heard people checking in, and I want to say good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone out there listening. What a wonderful, interesting group that have checked in. In terms of your question, Alan, when I was a young gymnast years ago, I think I found my calling, my passion for teaching. And not everyone has that particular passion. We each have to find our own heart's desire. But I realized one day that no matter how much I improved myself, only one person benefited. But if I could somehow share what I had learned with other people and influence their lives in a positive way, that excited me. That made my life more meaningful. So I began to teach what I knew, which was gymnastics, and then later movement in general, sports and movement and any kind of training. So I began looking at what qualities create talent for sport. and my researches in terms of what physical qualities needed to be developed, like strength, suppleness, stamina, and sensitivity, qualities like rhythm, coordination, timing, balance, and reflex speed, I found ways to train these things in people. And when I was coaching at Stanford University, my theories did bear out in practice. Our team went from the bottom of the conference when I first started there to one of the top three teams in the nation. When I left, I trained the top U.S. Olympian, and I might still be coaching today, but then I was dealing with my own personal problems, and I realized that being able to do somersaults and handstands and cartwheels and other physical skills didn't help me that much when I went out on a date, or when I got married, or when I had children, when I dealt with financial issues and career decisions and the many challenges we all face in daily life. So that's when I began to ask bigger questions, not what qualities create talent for sport, but what qualities create talent for living. And that led me, that passion, that calling led me to what I do now in terms of writing books and presenting lectures and seminars worldwide.
I made my living as an air show pilot for a long time. I loved flying and often said, you know, when I had the money to fly, I didn't have the time. When I had the time, I didn't have the money. And life is like that often, isn't it? In terms of often we don't, it's hard to make a living making or doing our passion. Can you recall the first time that you started to make a living from what was important to you?
Oh, I sure can. It's like one of those dollars you frame and put up on the wall. I always had different interests, and I was a kind of a stubborn guy. My daughters they went to Stanford and Harvard, very smart. They got straight A's, and they did well in all their classes, and that's sort of a blessing and a curse. I didn't have that curse. I did well in the classes that interested me, and I didn't do well in the classes that I wasn't interested in. It was so I always followed I trusted my heart. What am I here to do? And what felt most relevant to me, I pursued. Now, if my little girls had asked me, you know, way back then, Daddy, what should I do to make a living? I would have suggested do what you love and get someone to pay you for it. That's pretty good advice, but maybe idealistic. For people who are interested in the creative arts, for example, writing, music, painting, whatever creative arts they're interested in, I recommend that they think of their work as two jobs. One is that creative passion they have, and the other is a day job. Ideally, that day job is practical, is something they're good at, and also find value in. But that would be the bread and butter. That keeps them stable, so they can then have the free attention and the energy to pursue that creative passion. Unless someone likes the idea of being a starving artist, if that seems romantic to them, and they feel starving will help motivate them to be successful in their art, I haven't found that necessarily to be the case in most instances. So when my first book sold and my agent said, well, we've got an offer on your book, which was just amazing, he said, I'm going to give you some advice, which I never forgot. He said, don't give up your day job yet.
Yeah, right.
And so I've always had, I was coaching and then I also wrote. And many people do their creative passion on the side. For example, Jean Ayel, who wrote Clan of the Cave Bear, that best-selling book, she was a single mother of five children. And, you know, if anybody had an excuse, I don't have the time, she could have had it. But she got up at 4 a.m. and wrote until 7 every morning when it was time to get the kids up and go to school. So, again, we've all heard it. We don't have time, we make time. But in terms of the first dollar I ever made, one day I was out jogging. And it was really a hot day. I was sweating. My body felt really hot. And it struck me, you know, just the idea came to me that, gee, I wonder if I have some kind of like artificial fever because my body's so hot. Is this working out, this training creating a fever in my body that might do the same thing that the fever does if we're feeling ill, which is kill invading bacteria? Could jogging actually have health benefits beyond what we normally think of them, but actually create an artificial fever? So I had a friend do some research for me at the Stanford Medical School, and I wrote an article called Let's Catch Jogging Fever. And I got a check in the mail for $100 from Let's Live magazine. It was magical. I said, I actually sold my writing for money. And that was quite encouraging, and I kept writing, and the rest is, the last 25, 30 years.
Well, it's too bad that I didn't read that article. I never did catch that fever, actually, to do jogging, but there's still time.
Well, yeah. Who was it that said, when I get the urge to exercise, I'll lie down until it passes? that's another approach, and people have to find their own way.
Their own way.
Yeah. But let me just say something else. In terms of an historical context, you know, I once asked my father, who drove a lunch truck to different factories in downtown Los Angeles, a catering truck, and sold, food and snacks off that truck. I once said, Dad, does your work make you happy? And he looked at me, kind of puzzled. He said, well, it never occurred to me. Because he came from the Depression generation. He came from a generation of long times past where people didn't think about work fulfilling them. It was just all they could do was to make money to support their family. People traveled during the Depression to do anything for a dollar a day just to put some food on the table. We have the wonderful luxury now, many of us, to look for work that matches our values, our talents, that we find fulfilling. And it's a wonderful search, really a very productive search, because it forces us to really examine, who am I? What do I value? And it's not the same for everybody. So that is part of our spiritual path, really, that search for an occupation. You know, they call it the trying 20s, because people who are in their 20s, they try a little bit of this, they try that, natural part of the process. Young people would like to have a mental certainty. They know what their direction is going to be. But for most of us, we had to explore and experiment a bit.
Well, I sure know what you're talking about in regards to this, because I always said, well, as I get more rich and famous, you know, I'll pursue my passion. And it had to look a certain way, like a certain job or a certain activity that, you know, was flamboyant and exciting and all of those kind of things. But it's interesting, the more now that I'm becoming those things, the less I need it to be that way. That you know, what was it that Gandhi said before enlightenment, picking potatoes, after enlightenment, it was peeling potatoes. After enlightenment, peeling potatoes. That it doesn't really matter, does it, at the end of the day?
Well, the Arabs had a wonderful saying, they say, trust in God, but tie your camel. And I talk about living with our head in the clouds, but our feet in the ground. There is that dichotomy. We still need to take care of business down here on earth and function in practical ways in everyday life, even as we explore over time who we are, what our values are, and what kind of service we would like to perform in the world, what kind of preparation we need to do that service. Joseph Campbell once said that many people who pursue a particular path from the time they're very young, a direct line through college, graduate school, and so on, may climb to the top of their professional ladder and discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. And like the swim coach at Stanford when I was there, his name was Jim Gorin, and Jim went to law school and became an attorney and realized he didn't like doing that and ended up saying, what do I love? He said, it's swimming and coaching. He ended up being one of the most successful swim coaches in the country, finally having the courage to say, well, I want to do what I really love doing. And when that's possible, it's a wonderful thing.
Let's talk about some of those ingredients now, the ingredients for being able to live a life with passion. Good. Maybe let's just explore some of those.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Now, somebody came up to me once after a seminar and said, Dan, I feel so inspired. And I said, don't worry, it'll pass. Because it does pass, doesn't it? All emotions pass. Sometimes we feel this way, sometimes we feel that way. So if we're talking about a feeling, an emotion of passion, if most of us look at our lives, we notice, in fact, if we had a watch beep every 20 minutes during the day, and we wrote down exactly what we were feeling and doing just before that watch beep, we'd notice our feelings are changing all the time. Emotions are the weather patterns of the body. Sometimes we feel sunny, sometimes stormy, sometimes gray. So emotions all pass, and when we talk about living with a passion, I can offer a guaranteed way to do that. It's not a guaranteed way to feel passionate all the time. I don't think that's realistic. But it is a guaranteed way to live with passion and live as a verb, not just as a passive thing of existing, which is we bring passion, we bring enthusiasm, we bring in a certain intensity and focus into our lives, and we remember the value of what we are doing. That is how I know to live with passion. because it's so easy to become habituated to what we're doing. Most of us have the experience of hanging a painting on a wall or a poster on the wall. We first get this new poster or painting or decoration, and it's so neat. That's why we bought it. We put it up. We think this looks great here. Well, after a couple of days or weeks or months, we don't even notice it anymore. We just come in the house or our apartment, go to what we're doing. We hardly glance at it. Rarely. It's only the rare person who looks up every day and goes, wow, that still looks beautiful to me. Young children have that ability to have a book read to them over and over. They don't go, oh, I've already heard that. I've already seen that. But adults tend to habituate. We begin to see and just reject things. I already know that. I've already seen that. And we don't realize we know things deeper and deeper. So I think part of that idea of passion is to stay fresh. And like when I train people in movement arts, I tell them they never do the same thing twice. It's never the same. If you're really paying attention, it's always a little bit different. So noticing what's going on around us and how our life is changing, how our surroundings are changing, slightly different from the day before, that's another ingredient that can help us to live with a kind of freshness and engagement in life.
I think of the book, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and, of course, the beautiful integration of the search for the inner wisdom that all of us have available to us. And also, of course, a full engagement in an outer life. And what do you think what role does passion play in this process of drawing the inner and the outer? Some people would say that it gets in the way. Some people would say it's the glue. What do you say?
Well, I think there may be, in other words, let me put it this way. Those in developing nations where people wake up wondering if they're going to have enough to eat that day, and most of the world is in that condition. We forget that. In European countries, in America, Canada, Australia, certain other developed nations, we don't have to worry about that much. But in those nations, there was a saying Gandhi once said, to a starving man, God is bread. But for those of us in relatively comfortable circumstances, our attention can go to higher aspirations, to social relationships, even to what Maslow, the psychologist Abraham Maslow, called self-actualization or enlightenment. We have a different search, and many of us have become a little bit disillusioned. If we have had parents who've been very successful in the world, or if we've done that ourselves, and we go, I may not be really measurably happier than I was years ago when instead of a flat screen big TV, now we had a little set sitting on an apple crate. But I enjoyed myself just as much then, and now I've got a lot of other things to deal with. So those of us who become disillusioned with the Western search for happiness, which is possessions, money, status, and so on, often turn to the East. And we go, the answer's not in the West. We've seen the rat race. We've seen all the things, and it's empty ultimately. And so we turn our attention to the East, and we say the answers all lie within. The answer is detachment from the things of the world, from money, possessions, ego. I'm stepping off that race, and I'm just going inside. Well, that is the traditional Eastern solution to happiness. But I've traveled the world, and I've noticed there are many miserable Easterners, too. Because even though they may have, those who do a lot of the inner work and meditation have much self-knowledge, they have insight into their mind, and so on. But all the attention exclusively inside, people don't often handle what they need to handle outside. So maybe their relationships are falling apart, or their financial situation's in the toilet. In other words, they're having a difficulty in the outward world. So what I call the way of the peaceful warrior is not about going from the West to the East or bouncing back and forth. It's embracing the best of the East and West. With passion, both ways, really go inside with intensity, learn, self-discover, but also deal with the things of the world with equal enthusiasm, because rather than rejecting either one. And so it's embracing both. And passion is kind of the glue, is kind of the bridge. It's not about flesh or spirit, it's flesh and spirit, left brain and right brain, the wisdom of the indigenous peoples with modern technology, faith and reason, science and mysticism. So it's an inclusive approach to life and engaging it fully. And I think this is really a holistic, integrative approach rather than the traditional going from east to west or one to the other.
Oh, well said. Dan, I want to just take a moment to point our listeners to the URL around the new book, the new ebook experience. It's healthywealthyandwise.com/peacefulwarrior. Now, don't just go there just yet because it has audio attached to it, so you're going to have trouble listening to it and to this call at the same time, but it's healthywealthyandwise.com/peacefulwarrior. Dan, I want to talk about the Everyday Enlightenment book that you wrote. You talked in that book about 12 gateways to personal growth. Let's go through those gateways and with our listeners and how they apply to our subject tonight.
Sure. And, of course, Everyday Enlightenment is one of my 12 books, and each of my books are quite different from the others. They serve a different purpose. That particular book kind of redefines what we mean by success. It redefines the bigger picture of the practice of Everyday Enlightenment, freeing our attention by addressing 12 arenas of life. It's based on the premise that Earth is a school and daily life is our classroom. And daily life and the challenges we meet in relationship and health and finances and so on, those forms of spiritual weightlifting to strengthen our spirit, addressing those will teach us everything we need eventually to evolve as human beings. But if life is a school, what are the courses we need to pass in order to graduate, so to speak? And that's the 12 gateways that I go into in that particular book. And I'm just going to list them, first of all, and define them very briefly. This is an overview of those arenas we're all working on in life, every one of us. In fact, I would suggest that's what daily life is for. First, it's about discover our worth. We need to discover our innate worth. It's different from self-esteem. It answers the question, how good of a person am I? How much do I deserve of life's blessings? If we don't address that, we tend to self-sabotage. So that's the first gateway. The second is reclaim our will. And, you know, that's about the biggest challenge in life, right, is turning what we know into what we actually do. We all know how to live. We know about exercise and diet and everything else, but turning that into what we do, that's about reclaiming our will. The third gateway is energizing our body, and that makes sense. Those are the three foundations, like of a building. Discover your worth, reclaim your will, and energize your body. Because if you don't have energy, what have you got? As our grandmothers used to say, you know, if you don't have your health, what do you have? There are many people who are successful and wealthy who would trade it all for energy and vitality. The fourth gateway is manage our money. And that's often ignored in spiritual type texts, you know, People have issues about money versus spirit and thought forms and beliefs about money. And, you know, like Joe Lewis once said, he said, I don't really like money, but it calms my nerves. Often we have mixed feelings about money and are largely unexamined. So manage your money is about sufficiency and stability, establishing sufficiency and stability in that arena. And the fifth gateway is tame your mind, tame our mind. And that, I have a different take on that in the book than many people might imagine. And I go into meditation and all that, but there's a much different approach to taming our mind. The sixth gateway is trusting our intuition. It's a different way to live. It's like learning to think with the whole body rather than just the left brain. It's trusting our intuitive impulses, not just trying to figure everything out with the left brain and, you know, weighing the pros and cons, ins and outs, liabilities and benefits. Learning how to make a decision differently from just writing down the different variables. And the seventh gateway is accepting our emotions. Very important area of life. I mean, most of us, you know, when we say we were interested in personal growth, we're interested in success and achievement and enlightenment, most of us are really saying deep down, I want to find a way to feel good more of the time and feel bad less of the time. And so emotions are very important. But this chapter takes a very close look at how much control we have over our emotions. Do we or don't we? It's an interesting question, but it's about accepting our emotions as being natural to us in the moment. The eighth gateway is face our fears. Fear is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. And so there's a peaceful warrior's approach to facing our fears, very realistic and workable. The ninth gateway is to illuminate our shadow, which is really about self-knowledge, seeing ourselves realistically rather than through self-image. How can we accept ourselves if we don't know ourselves to the bone? So the tenth gateway is embrace our sexuality. Because we can't really go through life doing all those other things without finally confronting our fantasies, our fears, whatever issues we have around sexuality. And there's an old saying, the lesson is simple, the student is complicated. And we complicate food, we complicate, you know, diet, we complicate sexuality. And so I address some rational issues in that arena. The 11th semifinal gateway is awaken our heart. And of course, how could we pass without doing that? At the end, I go into a different take again on what that means and how to do it. And the 12th and final gateway is serve our world. And of course, without all the others, that brings us full circle to service, giving back, reconnecting to the world. Now, all these 12 gateways taken together free our attention for higher elements of life, for more subtle elements of life. Most of the time, we don't have free attention because our attention is trapped by subliminal muttering. You know, what am I going to do about my relationship? What am I going to do about my health issue, my money thing? And so we rarely have real free attention to look around with the eyes of a child again and see the beauty around us, the spirit around us. So that's what the purpose of the 12 gateways is, the higher purpose, so we can reach a place where we can actually practice enlightenment. And there's a section at the end of that book about actually how we can practice enlightenment. So hope that didn't go too long with that monologue, but that covers the 12 gateways.
Well, they are the 12 gateways. And it's interesting, isn't it, that I know some of our listeners will be thinking right now, okay, so which ones are the most important ones to work on?
Oh, easy. The most important ones are the most important ones to each individual. In other words, I emphasize in that book that no single gateway is more important than any of the others. Now, I will say the first three gateways, discover your worth, reclaim your will, energize your body, are foundation gateways. Because if you don't have any energy, if you don't have the will, and you don't have the worth, you won't allow yourself to benefit from any of the others. So they are like a foundation. But at different times, facing our fears may become the most important. Another time, embracing our sexuality or managing our money. So all these change over time, day to day, moment to moment. And I have great respect for the priorities and values and needs of each individual. I don't lay formulas on people. I'm not here for people to trust me. I'm here to help people trust themselves.
I think that a lot of us, in the West especially, got the idea that enlightenment was kind of like a bolt of lightning out of the sky, or suddenly there was this great awakening of an idea. And that it was, you did a whole bunch of meditation and then you just somehow passed over into this new place. But really, enlightenment comes after dealing with these 12 gateways, doesn't it?
Well, that's really what the gateways are for, to free our attention so we can begin to have our attention pierce the veils that normally are like a tip of the tongue feeling we can't quite break through. For example, I can give one key to enlightenment. Realize the idea that we don't know what anything is. Now, someone may hear that phrase, oh, okay, let's see, we don't know what anything is. And they may go, well, that's kind of interesting, or maybe it's not. Or they can intellectualize about it. They say, oh, that's very interesting, I'll contemplate that. But if someone actually had that idea pierce them, and realize that we can know any number of things about life, about, we could write encyclopedias about a pen we're holding in our hand. It's aesthetics, it's chemistry, it's physics, it's history. But we don't know what that thing is. We have a word for it, we call it pen. But we don't know what it is. Now, if someone went deeper, if they had the attention to actually get that, they would burst out laughing and actually in liberation. So we need the attention. That is the key. And that's why we need to address the 12 gateways in order to free our attention. And then we're ready. You know, Ramakrishna had a saying. He said, when you try to open a walnut, when the shell is green, it's almost impossible to open. But when you wait until it's ripe, just a tap, it may fall open. And in a way, our lives and these 12 gateways that we're all working on represent our ripening process. And once we are ripe, then some teacher may come along and just give us a tap. The idea of enlightenment sounds really dramatic. A sudden lightning bolt, someone smacks alongside the head with a cosmic oar, and suddenly we see the light. But I see enlightenment much more like a dimmer switch being turned up gradually over time. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down again. We remember, we forget. We see previews of coming attractions. We have moments of illumination. Because life is a series of moments. I've never met an intelligent person. I only met people with more intelligent moments, more enlightened moments. And each of us can increase those number of illumined moments, those moments of clarity, of kindness, compassion, of remembering in our lives over time.
I read my first self-help book when I was 8 years old. It was called How to Hypnotize Yourself. And I've said in seminars many times it must have worked because I spent the next 35 years unhypnotizing myself.
Right, I understand that.
And, you know, I mean, as much as 35 years of self-help and personal growth, and some guy will honk his horn more than 2 seconds longer than I think he should at some other guy, not even me, and I'm, you know, off the deep end about how inconsiderate people are and how, you know, did his mother have any children that lived and, you know, that kind of thing. My mind just goes nuts. You say, and, you know, you talk a lot about life being, or the daily life is our school, and every person that we meet is a teacher. How do we go about remembering that? How do you talk about that for a minute?
You know, I often tell, Alan Watts once said, beware of teachers who pick your pocket and sell you your own wallet. And I always got a kick out of that, because the irony is that's all any teacher can do. We do our best, but the treasure is inside each person. All we can do is point it out. In fact, I tell people in my seminars that all I can do is remind you of what you already know at deeper levels, but we tend to forget. I'm kind of like a yellow highlighter in the Book of Wisdom or the Book of Life. I just remind people of things. And the best I can promise is I might be able to provide some maps, maybe a light in the darkness so we don't stumble quite as much, and a kind of map to help people, maybe save them a little pain, unnecessary pain, and a little bit of time to traverse their own journey. So life, I see as our school, the world of nature, watching clouds pass, watching trees bend in the wind, streams flow around obstacles, can teach us all we need to know about life. It's not that we don't know these things. It's about translating them into action. And that's why I call action the basis of the peaceful warrior's way. Most of us have noticed that lessons seem to repeat themselves in life until we learn them. And in fact, if we don't learn the lessons the easy way, they tend to get harder in order to get our attention. A favorite story of mine about learning easier lessons instead of harder ones is about a man named John who was given a parrot named Maurice. I tell the story in one of my books called Living on Purpose. Anyway, he loved this bird, Maurice, beautiful parrot. The only problem was somebody had taught Maurice to curse like a sailor, and Maurice could just come out with some invective that would turn John, even embarrass him. His mother would come over, friends would come over, and this bird would let loose with these string of words, very colorful, and John tried everything to reform this bird. He played subliminal tapes and played New Age music and taught it affirmations, but nothing seemed to work. So one day, John reached the end of his rope, and he grabbed Maurice, just lost his temper, and, you know, like when someone honks their horn too long. And he grabbed the bird, opened the freezer door, stuck the bird in, and closed the freezer. Figured it would teach the bird a lesson. Of course, Maurice started cursing and squawking, but all of a sudden, dead silence. And John, all worried, oh, I hope I haven't hurt the bird. I didn't mean to do that. And he quickly opened the freezer and reached in. Well, Maurice walked calmly out on John's arm and stood on John's shoulder and said in John's ear, John, I would like to apologize and ask your forgiveness. I know my behavior of late has not been up to standards, and I know my language needs improvement, and I vow to do better in the future. Well, John said, well, that's great, Maurice. Pleasant surprise. Then the bird said, by the way, John, when I was in the freezer, I noticed there was a chicken wrapped up in there. Can you tell me what the chicken had done wrong? So, in other words, Maurice wanted to learn the easy lesson. He didn't want to learn the hard one. And some of us should be as wise as him and kind of get... And if I can relate a quick lesson from my everyday life, those who read Way of the Peaceful Warrior may recall that I shattered my right thigh bone, my right femur, in about 40 pieces in a motorcycle crash. That's depicted quite accurately in the Peaceful Warrior movie. And 20, 6 years later, ironically, the same day the Peaceful Warrior movie first opened here on the West Coast in California, I was going down a hill on my bicycle. It was a bicycle this time, but the same genetic predisposition that helped me be a champion gymnast made me rather stupid on bicycles. And I was doing high-risk behavior. I was going down this hill way too fast, turning wide around a corner because I was going so fast, and a car appeared at just the wrong place. It wasn't their fault, but I was going so fast I had to slam on the brakes, lay the bike down, and I broke my right leg, and my lower leg this time, in about three places and ripped some tendons out. So the point was, this was my wake-up call. I had to learn another lesson because I still didn't get it. And so it really was a wake-up call. I actually got the message this time that I need to kind of drive more defensively. And I've been doing it since then. So it could have saved my life. You never know. But that's an example. Sometimes we learn harder lessons. Sometimes we can learn a lesson in a dream and change our actions.
Glad you mentioned the book, or I'm glad you mentioned the movie, because it has been called a message movie and a lesson movie, of course, with Nick Nolte, and it shows, teaches, or shows your story and much more about your writings through that movie. It's released by Lionsgate. Lionsgate, of course, is named after Lionsgate Bridge, is right here in Vancouver, and so there's connection to it through that for me.
Isn't that great? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, for sure. That's where it was started. You talk about it in this movie. Nick Nolte's character shows great respect for which Socrates treated every person. You know, how he acted and how he treated each person who came to that gas station to get gas and the value of providing even simple services to others. What is the role of service, and is service the goal in itself, a service the goal in itself?
Service has been defined in different ways. It's our job, our calling, our profession. It's a way we connect with other people. And I like the word service rather than just a job or profession, because so often it's easy for us to think of our job in terms of what we get out of it, what kind of income we make, what kind of pleasures or consolations we get from it with workmates and so on. We're constantly sorting for what am I getting out of this. Same thing can happen with relationships. But what really creates a mature and strong human being is when we start sorting for what am I putting into this. Because what we put in ultimately is what develops us, not just what we get out. And so let me give an example. I was in Japan on the Shinkansen, which is the bullet train, waiting for a train going down to Kyoto. And while I was on this long platform waiting for the train, I looked behind me. It was almost an empty platform that time of day. And there was a little man whose job apparently was to polish kind of a railing. It had hundreds and hundreds of these silver uprights holding this railing going across the length of the station. And I watched him for a while, and he took at least 45 seconds to a minute to polish just one of the uprights to make sure every crack and crevice was clear and shining. And then he looked at it, and when he was satisfied, he moved to the other one. He had hundreds of those to clean. To me, I had discovered a Zen master. He took such pride in his work. To me, that was one form of service, to take pride in whatever we do and remember the value it has. Because when someone turns around and glances at that railing, it's going to be shining and beautiful and help improve the aesthetics of the environment. That counts for something. Where someone else might say, that's a meaningless job. But for him, it wasn't. He put meaning into that work. And to me, we can each appreciate whatever we do. Socrates once said to me, you know, it's not as important what you do as how you do it, how well you do it. So that's one approach to the role of service being a goal or an end in itself. But it's also a way to connect with people. What can we do to make a difference for someone else in our lives? You know, there's a story about Aldous Huxley. Many of us remember the name Aldous Huxley if we've ever read his book, Brave New World. It's a classic book, The Doors of Perception, and so on. But Professor Huxley, as much as any Westerner of his time, had explored the global heritage of spiritual traditions. I don't mean just read about them. He was an intellectual, but he also went to the different countries and did the practices. So he had great experiential wisdom. And when he was near death, one of his students said, "Professor Huxley, is it possible in any way for you to summarize all that you learned all these years?" And he said, "I'm a little embarrassed to say that I can summarize it all in maybe about 6 words. Try to be a little kinder." And I've never forgotten that, because it seems to me our service to the world, whatever we do, is a way to connect with people. Even if we're sitting alone in an office, as I do, writing, still reaching out to people, because that's what it's all about. If we're each cells on the body of this great being called planet Earth, our cells are here to connect and interact with other cells, and that's another way of looking at it. So to me, service is, you know, in the movie, Dan, the character of Dan, played by Scott Mecklowitz, a great young actor, I think, and he said to Socrates, "You know, what are you doing here in a gas station?" And he said, "Well, this is a service station. We provide service here." And he was kind to every single person that he met. And that's what I noticed, you know, in the book I described that, watching him in his interactions. One of the most spiritual people I know is a stockbroker, insurance salesman, financial planner. And Lou just uses that business as an excuse to connect with people, maybe uplift the people. And I think that's a good way to approach whatever we do.
You know, it's interesting to have Nick Nolte as that character, Socrates, because he has a real gruff way about him. And that gruffness can be mistaken for not kindness or unkind, but it really isn't. I guess it takes us some understanding and realization to see the, I guess, the difference between understanding and realization, to see the difference between what a person is saying or doing and what they're really doing. It takes fresh eyes to see that, doesn't it?
Sure. Some people can speak gruffly, but they're speaking from their heart. They're actually aware of their heart while they're speaking. And even in a gruff voice, they communicate that. You know, if you put two guitars next to one another and you pluck the E string on one guitar, they're in tune. It's going to start resonating the E string on the guitar next to it. It's called sympathetic or harmonic resonance. And the same thing works for the human voice. If we speak from our heart, just a simple awareness of our heart, it resonates the heart of those who are listening. And so I think this is important. These are ways to provide service as well. There are many little things we can do that I go into in some of my other books, little things that can make a big difference in life, small forms of service that ultimately enrich our lives. And we feel better at the end of the day. It was like, wow, you know, I did some nice things today. Not just I got some nice things today, but I did some nice things today.
Well, I haven't seen the movie. It's certainly top of my list to see. And people can see a trailer about the movie at this URL that I've been mentioning before, healthywealthyandwise.com/peacefulwarrior. You got it, healthywealthy, and then the N, wise.com/peacefulwarrior. People can learn more about the movie there. Is there a difference between understanding and realization? And why is that difference significant?
Oh, there's a significant difference. Before I mention it, I might add there's one other URL. If people are curious about my work, they can just go to peacefulwarrior.com. It also links to the trailer and theater listings and all that. Right now, the movie is only out in about 50 theaters or 40 theaters. It may get a wide release later this year. The DVD will probably be out in December. So I thought I'd mention that regarding the film project. And Nick Nolte, I should add, was wonderful as Socrates, because nothing sounds preachy out of his mouth. And I think you'll really enjoy the movie when you see it. It's quite extraordinary. So in terms of the difference, as Socrates once told me, between understanding and realization, I guess one way to communicate it, Alan, is there's an old saying, "I hear and I forget. I see and I remember. I do and I understand." Now, that understanding is like realization. I don't want to get lost in semantics here. But the point is, we can understand intellectually certain ideas, but when we experience it, then we realize what it is. Let me give you an example. Most of my life when I grew up, I understood when I described it, someone says, a loop-the-loop in an airplane, you know. I said, I know what it means to do a loop in an airplane. I've seen it in movies. I've read about it. I understand it. But one day, a friend of mine said, hey, Dan, you want to go up in my Cessna Aerobat with me and fly around? And I said, sure. So we went up in the air, and we flew around for a while. He let me take the controls, and then he said, okay, let's do a loop. And I said, yeah. And we dove down, get high speed, and then we pulled the stick back, and it went straight up and just over the top. Many people have done that on a roller coaster. And then we came around again. And for the first time in my life, I realized what a loop-the-loop meant. I could have studied it and seen it time and time again, but until I experienced it directly, I never realized what it was really like. And what that has to do with spiritual practice is that we can understand a lot of concepts. And many of us think that's what the game is about. And we talk the talk, we know the jargon, and we read the books. But when we practice, when we have done some meditation, when we have practiced with kindness, when we have done various practices, inner and outer, we begin to realize what this is about. A different quality of life, a different quality of moment. You know, we can talk about, oh yes, living in the present moment. I know what that is. I've read the books, you know. Yes, present moment. But how many of us actually practice it? How do we do that? It has to do with breathing. It has to do with relaxation. It has to do with focusing on doing what we do with a certain elegance, which brings us back to the body, back to the present moment. So again, balancing the body, you know, that's another kind of realization.
Well, I got to tell you, it feels a lot different in the middle of the snowbird demonstration team, which was a great thrill of mine. Of course, your equivalent in the United States, the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds. I got to ride with the Canadian Snowbirds and do those loops that you were talking about in the middle of that.
Wow.
And that was an incredible realization. You know, it's interesting. I kind of skipped. I think this kind of goes in three stages, kind of body, mind, and then heart. And you pursued the body because you went into gymnastics and sport, and I pursued wine, women, and song at that same time in my life. So I kind of skipped the body atonement part. And then, but then I got really interested in the mind, and I think what our self-help movement, our personal development movement for many, many years, maybe 20 or 30 years now, has been the pursuit of, understanding the mind and getting control over the mind. But it makes a transition. At one point in time, you know, I studied, and ended up with credentials in five different models of psychology, and I could give you the points and counterpoints from every angle of those five models. But then I realized that I was playing chess with myself. I mean, eventually the mind is, you know, you're playing both sides of the chess game, aren't you? And then it realized that I had to find my heart. And that, I think, is what we're heading into. And I think the evidence is how heartless it is in the world in some ways when we look out on some things, that it must be that we're trying to discover our heart because of all the shenanigans that's going on. Talk about that for a moment.
We need to become disheartened today as we read the news and see once again how we seem to have found ourselves in a predicament and created a predicament because we continually, as human beings, are still less than enlightened, and we still are willing, and I say we as humanity, maybe not you or I or anyone listening to this conversation, but there are a significant number of humans who lack self-respect, who are suffering deeply, who don't see much meaning in life, and some of them, their death seems more meaningful to them than their life. And they are... So... they're willing to cross the line we call violence. If humanity just reached that one place where we are willing to argue and have differences, but no matter what happened, we weren't willing to cross the line of injuring or killing other people, that would radically, radically change our world. So I'm not talking about enlightenment. I'm not talking about everyone loving everybody. but just that simple boundary where it has become unacceptable to do violence to others. That would be quite an achievement. And many of us on an individual level have learned that. We avoid violence in our daily lives. We may be angry at someone, but we don't strike out at them. And in my own life, I've found that I have more control, relatively speaking, over my behavior, over how I move my arms and legs, than I do about stopping certain thoughts from happening in my awareness. I don't have a spam filter for thoughts. Many thoughts arise that are positive, many thoughts arise that are negative. I'm not troubled by them. I accept them as natural to me in the moment. So I'm not so much trying to fix my mind, I'm not so much trying to fix my emotions anymore so I can feel all the right emotions like courage and compassion and kindness and love, because I've noticed feelings come and go. They pass like the weather. So I focus more these days on what I do. And it may take a while for us to reach the stage of evolution where human beings focus on what they do. Let me give a quick example. Let's say a little boy hits his baby sister, and his mother sees him doing that, and she goes, "Why did you hit your baby sister?" Because everybody likes reasons for things. Well, he really hasn't a clue. He just had the impulse to hit her, and he did. Maybe he was jealous or something. Who knows? But he couldn't articulate that, so he said, "I'm hungry." Well, she said, "That's not any excuse." He said, "Well, I hate her." And now, one mother might say, "Well, that's terrible. Look at your baby sister. She's an innocent little baby. You shouldn't hate your baby sister." But you know what a wise mother might say? She might say, "Yeah, yeah, it's fine to hate your baby sister. Just don't hit her."
Right.
Now, that little boy is going to grow up sane. He's going to grow up non-neurotic because he's going to grow up saying, "It's okay, whatever I'm feeling, but I'm still responsible for what I do." And if most of us could live that way, and accept our emotions and thoughts as natural to us in the moment, without being in conflict or worrying about having the wrong thoughts or wrong feelings, let them come, they'll pass anyway, and focus on what is my purpose, what is a positive, constructive purpose right now, and then doing what needs to be done in line with our purpose. That, to me, is a way to master the body, to balance the body, and not wait for the right motivation and the right ideas and the right thoughts and the right discipline and the right technique, so we can finally go out and live well. Just focus on what do I need to do now. Now, that's not always easy. You know, I don't want to make it seem like, oh, just go and just do it. You know, if you need to lose weight, stop eating so much, exercise more. If you're addicted to something, just stop doing it. Of course not. Of course not. In an ideal world, well, yeah. But most of us need to go through a process, and it's important for us to be gentle with ourselves. We beat ourselves up because we learn something, we expect to manifest it totally right there. But it can take some months or years to fully embody what we've learned. It's a process. So some people who have addictions go through a 12-step program or other process whereby they're finally ready to face the action of just stopping the behavior. But it can take time. And some people need some tender loving care, who need to lose weight and explore themselves and learn more about themselves, and that's part of their process. But it always comes down to, what will we do in this moment? Doesn't sound very spiritual, doesn't sound very metaphysical, but that's what's going to shape our lives.
I'm glad you said that, talked about that, because so many people, especially people on this call and who visit Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, are people who have done a lot of work on themselves, and you know, you get to that point where you know better. I know better. I shouldn't be doing it this way. And, or I still continue to do it this way. And then what sets in is, you know, what Ken Wilber calls, of course, New Age guilt, where, you know, you feel guilty because you're feeling guilty. And it's a trap. It's a real trap on the way to enlightenment, for sure, to not be gentle with yourself. Maybe just expand on that even a little bit more, because I think it's a major piece for people who are doing work on themselves in this day and age.
Yes. Yes. Well, the fact is judgments only hold the patterns in place. By judging ourselves and saying, "Oh man, I messed up again," or "Oh, when will I be able to, you know..." Let me put it this way. What happens is, when our awareness expands, it takes us into a place of disillusion. we become disillusioned, freeing from illusions. We begin to see the mistakes we're making. And the awareness of a problem is the beginning of the solution, but it often seems as if we're getting worse. If you imagine walking by a well in the forest, this well, and there's flowers growing around it, and vines, and it looks quite lovely, and inside the well, it's just darkness. It looks quiet and peaceful. But if the sun should shine right overhead and shine down in directly into that well, suddenly we can see the creepy crawlies in there that are living in there. And that happens to ourselves as well. That's shadow work. We see parts of ourselves that, you know, maybe aren't so admirable. But that's a freeing, that's a profound moment, because that's when we can really come to grips with it. But we need to embrace that part of ourselves as well. It's a part of our humanity. I mean, one great form of shadow work is relationships. I mean, how many of us, how many listeners out there have had a relationship difficulty and seen some parts of themselves that maybe they're not too crazy about, you know? But it's a humanizing influence. We get more compassion, we get more realistic, we break through all that self-image, and we see ourselves as we are. And there, but for the grace of God, go I, you know? And so we become more human, and I think it's very important for us to treat ourselves with the respect and kindness we might treat a child who's just learning about life, because in a way, we're still, that's where we are. And rather than just doing the whole achievement thing where we used to do it, you know, in the external world, pushing ourselves and driving ourselves and projecting our parents expect this of us or other people expect it of us, but really it's just us pushing ourselves. When I was coaching at Stanford University, I walked into the gym one day, Alan, and I saw the captain of the team lying on the floor, stretching his legs, which, you know, you do before workout. And he was holding one of his legs, pulling his straight leg all the way up to his chest. But I heard him muttering to himself, "Oh, this hurts so bad, I hate this." And I looked at him. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I mean, I thought I'd walked into some kind of bizarre comedy. I wanted to say, "Who's doing it to you?" And often we do the same thing to ourselves, when that's not what life is about. It's about kind of gracefully, gently going through life, making mistakes. You have to make mistakes. It's still how we learn. And then learning from them and going on with it. Life is two steps forward, one step back. It's not about not falling down. Life is about falling down and then getting up again. We've all, in the boxing ring of life, we've all been up against the ropes at times. Most of us hit the canvas once or twice. I know I have. But then we're up again. We got back up, and that's the main thing. So that's why I say it's easier to have compassion for other people when we've extended a little bit of that to ourselves.
My good friend Chuck Spazzano says if you did to yourself, I don't know, how does he say this? If you were doing to others what you do to yourself, you'd be arrested.
So true.
So, listen, we've got a few minutes. I wanted to just talk about your books and that. Just give people a break. It's been incredibly deep and wonderful, meaningful connection here with you tonight and what you're saying. But let's talk about, you've got a new project that you're working on, or that have you finished the book, the next one that's coming out?
Actually, I just finished it yesterday, and it's called Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior. I think it'll be of interest to anyone, whether or not they've read Way of the Peaceful Warrior. What it does is, you know, for years, Alan, people have been asking me, what did Socrates mean by this, and what did he mean by that? How come he railed against moderation, or how come he said you have to be wealthy to be happy? And he made these outrageous statements, and that's just how he was. And I wrote a number of other books thinking, well, now I'm clarifying, I'm explaining it all. I wrote No Ordinary Moments, The Life You Were Born to Live, Everyday Enlightenment, we all went through some of that, a number of other books, but I never actually addressed paragraph by paragraph those points he made, the major teachings. So in Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior, 25 years after the first book came out, with the release of the movie, actually, I said, you know, it's time to write this book, and I took excerpts, all significant excerpts of teaching points from Way of the Peaceful Warrior, the substance of it, and I shed new light on those teachings by making commentaries on that section from my current sensibility of 60 years that I didn't have when I wrote the book. So, and my publisher is quite happy with it, and so I think other people will be too. And that's what the book is about. And the ebook you mentioned actually is based upon elements from Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior. But it also includes video clips of my lectures and also audio clips where people, so it's multimedia. People get to hear it and see things as well as reading the simple basic text.
I also wanted to just pay tribute to Ruby Yeh, who is the producer of that ebook experience that people can access by going to the URL that I mentioned before, healthywealthyandwise.com, /peacefulwarrior. I work with you, Ruby. I work with Ruby on the Wisdom Business Network series, and she is just an outstanding individual, just a wonderful, wonderful person. So I know anything that she's involved with will be just simply outstanding for sure.
Talk about living with passion. Ruby is a gem, just a dynamo. She's just amazing, and she was a producer and, in a sense, publisher of this ebook. And actually helped me get the hard copy book, you know, written too. Because she said, it's time. We've got to get this going. And she's a good coach. Good coach.
Yeah, but we have three questions that we ask on this series of everyone that comes on it to help people translate what they've heard tonight and translate that into meaningful actions in the world and other things like that. Let me ask you the first one now. What role does the body play in the process of realization? And missed it here. Hold on. Will you share with your listeners, Dan, three things that they can do in the coming week, so to begin putting into practice some of the principles that you've been talking about here?
Oh, I'd be happy to do that. You know, my background as an athlete is that rather than just talk about abstract concepts and ideas, it's all about practice. It's all about doing it. And so I, you know, many of us have these dreams and these ideas, and we're encouraged to dream. And so what I often recommend to people is to dream big, but start small, and then connect the dots. So get big dreams. Get a vision that inspires you, that something that you'd be happy to get up in the morning and do, something that stretches you a little bit. Whatever field you're in, the kind of thing that brings up self-doubt, the kind of thing that says, I don't know if I could do that. And, you know, how will we know unless we try? Let me tell one more story here. This is not in any of my books, so this is one of the first times I've shared it. I was in the gas station, the service station, with Socrates, and I was about to go somewhere, you know, to a tryout in gymnastics. And he said, well, wait a minute, just help me with this. Here's a bottle of, a case of oil. And this was a cardboard case with a bunch of cans of oil in it, and he gave it to me. It was quite heavy. And I was holding it there, and you can imagine that, and I'm, you know, it's in my arms. And then I said, okay, where do you want me to put it? He said, well, no, I just got one more. Well, he put the second one on. This I can barely hold. And so I got two of these cases. And I'm almost collapsing. I was pretty strong, but I said, Sock, that's it. Where do you want me to put these? I can't hold it too long. He said, oh, I just have a little more. And he put a couple more cans on top. And he said, I said, Sock, that's it. That's all. Come on, where should I put it? I got to put it down. He said, just a couple more cans. And finally, the thing just, my arms gave way, and it just collapsed. And I was kind of disheartened. And I said, so this is some kind of test, right? And I failed. And he laughed and laughed. He said, Dan, he said, life is not about success or failure. It's about finding your limits. How will you know your limits unless you've gone for something that really stretches you? Some of us have done these ropes courses and other challenging courses to find out where our limits are, to live on that edge now and then, and do it in safe ways. And I think that, you know that saying, bite off more than you can chew and then chew it. So I don't know if that counts as three things in terms of dream big, but start small. Another example. Many people go, you know, I know I should exercise regularly. We all know that. Very important. Exercise moderately almost every day. But I mean to do it, but I'm going to join a gym in a few weeks when I have time. I'm kind of tired now. Got a good job, and so on. But for those who know it would be good to exercise, but don't do it, here's what I recommend. I recommend you get up tomorrow morning and do one jumping jack. And then the next morning, you do another jumping jack. And the next morning, you get up, do one more jumping jack. Just one each morning. Now, after 30 days, someone could come up to you and say, by the way, do you exercise regularly? Yeah, absolutely, religiously. You know, every day I get up and do my jumping jack. Now, you now have an exercise period, albeit small, that you exercise, you set aside every day. And the second month, you might do two jumping jacks, double your workout. And you might decide to walk halfway around the block or move to some music and stretch and breathe deeply. You might even learn the Peaceful Warrior Workout, which is a workout I've done every day for about 24 years, every day. But it's designed to be completed in less than 4 minutes a day. Based on the principle, a little of something is better than a lot of nothing.
Really?
And so that's one of the keys for bringing what we know into what we actually do. Start small. You don't have to, if you want to do service, you don't have to become Mother Teresa right off. Maybe pay somebody's toll going over a toll bridge. Or say a kind word to the person at the supermarket who's a checkout clerk. Little things can make a big difference in the eyes of spirit. So that's the second part. First is dream big. Second is start small. If you want to meditate, you say, you know, I know it would be good for me. I used to meditate, but I don't know, you know, I don't know if I have the time. I meditate every single day for at least 15 seconds. But I do it every day. And that makes a difference. The body gets into that rhythm. That's what I mean by starting small. And then you can build from there. Then you connect the dots. To me, that's a practical, realistic way to approach life that people can actually do in the coming weeks.
Yes. Less does become more eventually, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That you know, at first, you know, it's all about more, right? More life, more this, more of everything. And I am in that point right now in my life, 53 years of age, where I'm getting as much appreciation out of laying down with my cat and letting him lay on my chest and fall asleep than I am, you know, doing all of the wonderful things I do in the world and all of the people I talk to and reach out through the Success Talk channels and that kind of thing. I think it was the head of the UN who said once, it takes a lot more courage to love the one than it does to love the many. And in that, I'm just loving my cat right now. Him and I have got this love affair going on that is just opening my heart.
Yeah, yeah, those simple things sure make a difference, to remember those simple pleasures. Yeah, again, it's one of those things we all know, but actually living that way, to enjoy those simple pleasures, to take a deep breath as we walk outside, go for a little walk, and notice the breeze rippling with the leaves above us, and the sun cutting through the trees. Those kinds of things really are what make life. It's not just the big stuff. The big stuff happens only once in a while, but just letting a cat fall asleep on your chest, that's a beautiful way of putting it out.
Healthy and Wealthy and Wise believes strongly in the power of intention and to manifest outcomes. What project, what current most important project do you have, and what intention could and would you like us to and our listeners to hold for you around that?
Well, truly, the most important project I have are these moments with you. This moment right now is always my most important project, and then this moment, and then this moment. But in a larger picture, in terms of the work I'm doing, well, I continue to write more books. I'm about to start a new book, which will be out sometime next year, perhaps, called My Search for Spirit, which is going to be entirely nonfiction, total memoir, nothing made up or exaggerated, about some other mentors I've met and masters I've met that represent the archetypal spiritual journey and the lessons I've learned along the way. I have another story coming up. One of my recent books called The Journeys of Socrates is probably the best writing I've done. It's the story of my old mentor and his life. And it's an emotional roller coaster. And that book may end up being a movie, so I may be working on the screenplay for that down the line. But there are different projects. I put myself in the place of people listening right now. People get to hear my story, but I'd like to acknowledge that each listener has his or her own story, too. And we've all faced physical, emotional, mental pain in our lives, and we all have faced adversity. And I want to acknowledge everyone's stories and their lives unfolding. You never know what the next chapter is going to bring. So I think my current project is less important than all of your current projects and what the listeners are doing, because that's really what's important, all of us together. I don't see a separation between us. So your projects are mine, and mine are yours. It's not really separate. Your failures are mine. Your successes are mine, and vice versa. So we really are in this together, and we need that vision of our essential unity, even though we appear separate. And that's what a growing realization in my life.
Be careful what you ask for. I remember one time I interviewed the leader of a very large spiritual community, and one of the things that they do is pray for people. And I asked them to send, we were trying to make a major jump with the Success Talk channels at that point in time, and I said, could you get your people to pray for me and pray for us and our project? And he said, sure, we do this all the time. And so for the next week, all my computers blew up. I mean, literally, and that's a true story.
Yeah.
And so I talked to another group that had asked, kind of talked about the same thing, done the same thing, and said, oh, yeah, that's quite standard for them. They do that all the time. You've got to really be careful. what single idea would you like to leave with our listeners tonight, Dan?
Occasionally I am asked if I can just summarize or if there's one idea, one concept. I would have to say, really reaching out through the phone lines, through the airwaves here, I would like to reach out to everyone listening and encourage you to trust the process of your life unfolding. To me, it all comes down to that. Stress happens when the mind resists what is. Life is going to unfold as it pleases, and sometimes it's pleasurable and convenient, and other times it's inconvenient and even painful or challenging. But if, to me, faith, F-A-I-T-H, faith, is the courage to live our lives as if everything that happens is for our highest good and learning. And that's what we're here for. One of those four purposes of life. We're here to learn and to evolve. And if we've been an athlete, we know some of the toughest days and toughest periods we went through is when a lot of the learning was going on. That's when the breakthroughs were getting ready to happen. And then they manifested in the better days. So there are really no bad days. There are less pleasant experiences, but the lessons are always positive. So to remember that and to trust the process of our lives unfolding, to trust ourselves, to remember that every choice leads to wisdom, and that there is no best path, best teacher, no best religion, no best martial art, no best diet. There is only the best one for each of us at a given time. And we're given that divine spark of intelligence to make our own choices and learn the lessons we're here to learn.
Well, Dan Millman, I know your worthiness will allow you to receive the idea that you are a leader and a visionary and a lamplighter of our time, and we are just so grateful that you took the time today to visit with us and to share these ideas. I know that they will carry forward into the world through all of our listeners. Thanks so much for joining us.
I wish everybody a good journey.
Janet, I'll pass it back to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Alan. And Dan, what a blessing to have you with us. Your work is such an inspiration. I'm just so grateful that you've been able to be with us this evening. So thank you again.
My pleasure.
Once again, for our listeners, be sure to get a copy of Dan's amazing multimedia ebook by going to www.healthywealthy.com/peacefulwarrior. Also, you can learn all about all of Dan's work by going to www.peacefulwarrior.com. www.peacefulwarrior.com. And be sure to join us on August 22nd when we interview Scott Martineau, co-founder of ConsciousOne.com, one of the most successful websites on the Internet with over 600,000 members. And we'll be talking with Scott about his new book called The Power of You, which will be released on August 15th. Then on September 5th, our dear friend Mark Victor Hansen will co-host our interview with music legend Willie Nelson. So this will be an incredible interview, and you won't want to miss it. It's going to be a lot of fun. Remember, you can always check the schedule of our upcoming interviews by going to www.healthywealthy.com/schedule. Until then, thank you all for joining us and for your commitment to living your passions and giving your gifts. We'll open up the lines now and say good night. Good night, everyone.